Asperger's syndrome has been in the news a lot in recent months, first as it was revealed that the new diagnostic manual from the American Psychiatric Association would not include Asperger's anymore. Then after the school shooting tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, speculation about the shooter having Asperger's was reported by the news media. This hour we'll discuss the recent attention to Asperger's and life as a person with Asperger's syndrome. That's after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Former Republican Senator Chuck Hagel is listening to claimed pros and cons about him this hour as his defense secretary confirmation hearing begins. Democratic Senator Carl Levin says Hagel has allayed his doubts about Hagel's positions on Iran and Israel. And Levin says Hagel would be the first former enlisted man and Vietnam War veteran to serve as Secretary of Defense.
It would be a positive message for our soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines in harm's way around the world.
Republican James Inhofe is one from Hagel's own party who says he does not support Hagel.
Too often, it seems, he's willing to subscribe to a worldwide view that is predicated on appeasing our adversaries while shunning our friends.
Former Senator Sam Nunn testifies that war for Hagel is not an abstraction and says Hagel will use all of the country's tools and not solely force to defend the U.S. Israeli officials will not confirm that they were behind an airstrike on a weapons convoy in Syria. But as Linda Gradstein reports, Israeli officials hint that Israel could take similar action in the future.
Israel is officially refusing comment on the airstrike, but U.S. officials were reportedly told that the target was a convoy of anti-aircraft weapons destined for Hezbollah guerrillas in Lebanon. A senior Israeli lawmaker, Tzachi Hanegbi, told Army Radio that Israel has always said that if sophisticated weaponry from Iran, Russia, or North Korea were to fall into Hezbollah's hands, that would cross a red line. Syria said the airstrike hit a Syrian research facility and two people were killed. Israel this week stationed an Iron Dome anti-missile battery in the north, near its borders with Syria and Lebanon. For NPR News, I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Federal, state, and local authorities are on the scene as a hostage situation drags on in southeast Alabama. Tuesday afternoon, as a school bus full of children stopped near a church, a man reportedly boarded it, shot and killed the driver, and abducted a kindergartner with special needs. Dan Carson of member station WBHM reports he's been holed up with the boy in an underground bunker ever since.
Authorities are calling the situation static but delicate. Alleged shooter and kidnapper Jimmy Lee Dykes, described by neighbors as a paranoid and combative Vietnam veteran, has allowed medication to be delivered to his 5-year-old captive. Police are communicating with him through a PVC pipe connected to the bunker on his property. Dykes is said to have extreme anti-government views and had been due in court Wednesday on a menacing charge. Neighbors told media he'd threatened them, regularly patrolled his yard with a gun, and killed their pets. His bunker has electricity. The boy has reportedly been coloring and watching TV. Children who were on the bus Tuesday said Dyke shot the 66-year-old driver 3 or 4 times when he would not turn over students. For NPR News, I'm Dan Carson in Birmingham.
From Washington, this is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com.
Good morning. It's 10:04 and 26 degrees. I'm Debbie Holmes, WOSU News. Governor John Kasich will reveal today his proposal to fix school funding. Ohio Supreme Court has ruled 4 times that the state system for funding public schools is unconstitutional because it relies heavily on local property taxes. Ohio Democrats are hoping the governor provides more funding to schools. State Representative Matt Lundy is also concerned about the proposal, including merit pay for teachers.
The whole performance pay issue is basically a mini Senate Bill 5. It's a backdoor way of getting in on the collective bargaining. Ohioans have been very clear they support collective bargaining in this state. I think the governor needs to stay away from that backdoor approach.
The governor has a series of events scheduled today, including a virtual town hall meeting beginning at 6 p.m. You can see that at kasichforohio.com. No decision yet from Ohio's junior U.S. senator on whether he'll vote to confirm former GOP Senator Chuck Hagel for Secretary of Defense. Republican Bob Portman says he'll closely monitor Hagel's confirmation hearings that start today.
But I do have some very serious concerns about Senator Hagel's views on the issues. So I will be listening carefully. I mean, these are incredibly important issues.
Portman says he's especially interested in Hagel's answers on Iran, military preparedness, and the U.S. relationship with Israel. A Franklin County juvenile judge has ordered a mental evaluation of one of the teens charged in the fatal shooting of another boy during an after-school fight earlier this month. The judge wants to determine if 17-year-old Shaquan Washington is competent to stand trial. He and a 15-year-old boy face a delinquency charge of murder in the January 17th slaying of 15-year-old Kawan Coleman near Lyndon McKinley STEM Academy. I'm Debbie Holmes, WOSU News.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The American Psychiatric Association in May will publish its fifth edition of Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, which includes many changes this year, including the decision to include Asperger's syndrome under the broader autism spectrum diagnosis. Asperger's as a separate disorder will go away. This is a controversial issue for some who are comfortable with the Asperger's label or who are uncomfortable with the autism label or just change in general. Joining us now to talk about these changes in Asperger's and the autism spectrum diagnosis in general is Diane Bucci. She's author of the memoir, The Return of Mikey, about her late son who had Asperger's syndrome. Welcome to the show, Diane.
Hi, how are you doing?
Diane is also former president of the Autism Society of California, and she joined us by phone from Colorado. I'm sorry, Society of Colorado. She joined us by phone from Colorado. Also with us is Brenda Miles. She has written numerous books and articles about educating and treating children with Asperger's and autism. She's a former professor of special education at the University of Kansas. She now is a consultant with the Ohio Center for Autism and Low Incidence. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Question for our listeners, are you the parent of a child who was diagnosed with Asperger's, or do you yourself have Asperger's, or were you diagnosed with Asperger's? Do you have concern about the changes in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. And a note to our listeners, we did ask the American Psychiatric Association to provide a representative to join us today. They were unable to grant that request. According to their website, DSMfacts.org, they believe that, quote, the revised diagnosis represents a new, more accurate and medically and scientifically useful way of diagnosing individuals with autism-related disorders. Brenda Miles, was this change a surprise to those of you working in the autism education community?
It wasn't a surprise. We knew that the committee was working toward that, and the change is one that can be very beneficial for individuals with autism or may have an impact that we have not discussed yet.
But you said they've been talking about it,
right.
So you weren't surprised or you were
no.
surprised? Okay.
Not surprised at all. The idea was to bring together individuals with autism spectrum disorders, and quite frankly, the majority of research that we have right now has been done with individuals with classic autism and less research with individuals with Asperger's. And there's not a clear indicator at this point in time to differentiate the two. And that was the impetus behind the change.
Now, I understand that you're not completely against the change, but you have concerns. So first of all, what works for you about the change? What you just talked about, that there aren't distinctions enough to separate them?
Absolutely. I support the definition change because, as you said, there isn't enough research to support the difference. However, we don't know the impact upon individuals on the spectrum. One study showed that individuals are less likely to be identified with autism. Another study showed just the opposite. So I'm concerned about the impact on families who have an individual who might need a diagnosis. I'm also concerned from a research standpoint.
Yeah.
Individuals who have high-functioning autism or were once known as having Asperger's syndrome represent the majority of individuals on the spectrum. However, If you look at data, little research has been done on the strengths and needs of that population. And I'm afraid with the change, we may not see additional research.
Diane Bucci, your son, Mikey, your late son, Mikey, was diagnosed with Asperger's. What do you think of the change from your experience raising a child with Asperger's?
He was actually originally diagnosed with mild autism when he was 3, and then when the Asperger's syndrome label came into use, he was around 7 or 8, and they re-diagnosed him with that. I was actually against it at the time.
Okay.
I did not like the Asperger's label because it took us so long to get awareness of the autism label. In fact, when he was diagnosed, the DSM manual had recently finally classified autism as a disorder rather than a disease, and that had taken a lot of lobbying from parents and doctors and professionals to get it classified as a disorder because it will give you more insurance coverage rather than a disease. So it felt like we were going backwards because all of a sudden Mikey had this label on him that wasn't, you know, it had no awareness. If I said he had Asperger's syndrome, nobody knew what I was talking about, where people were finally understanding the autism label. And so I didn't like that in the first place. I felt like we were just memorializing Dr. Asperger because he did a study on high-functioning autistic people.
Back in 1944.
Yeah, and so I never liked it. I am actually for the change. I think that, number one, it makes it much more clear to understand the symptoms of the disorder. Mikey had every symptom of autism, and it's just for public awareness. Schools, you know, most teachers know what autism means, where they may not have any idea what Asperger's label means.
You know, Asperger's seems like such a common label to me now. I know when it first came out, a lot of people didn't know, but it has been some years now. And since that time, Diane Bucci, a lot of your colleagues, other parents have grown up with their children with that label. Out in the community, does everybody share your comfort level with the change?
No, absolutely not. I think most parents who have a child with the Asperger's label feel uncomfortable with the autism label because there's more of a stigma on it. And that's really one of my big reasons for being pro the change, because I think people like Mikey was, people who are high functioning, who have that label, they will do more to erase the stigma of the autism label if they have the same label. I know Mikey called himself autistic. He didn't have any problem telling people he had autism or Asperger's. So it's almost like a social thing where Asperger's doesn't sound as bad as autism. So people who have grown up with that label don't want to have the autism label. Hmm. And so I know my viewpoint is probably in the minority for parents.
I guess ultimately it cuts both ways, Brenda Miles?
Oh, it absolutely does. I know a number of adults with Asperger's syndrome whose identity is Asperger's syndrome. And as a result, they're very concerned that they're losing something that it took years for them to obtain. And Diana's exactly right. And we don't have a definitive answer. Only time will tell. The thing that we must be diligent about is to make sure that all individuals who may be on the spectrum get the diagnosis they need in order to get the support and treatment that they need.
Yeah, the Associated Press reported that some critics of the decision to eliminate the separate Asperger's disorder diagnosis have said that doing so may affect the special education services that these children previously received and make it harder for them to get treatment. Why is that?
Well, first of all, in the education system, it should not make a difference because according to IDEA and education, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, there is only autism. And so in the schools, a child would never be identified with Asperger's syndrome. So from that standpoint, we now have education in line with the medical community. Now, it may affect other services, but it should not impact education.
Is that something that people are worried about? You mentioned insurance, Brenda, but is there an issue with the educational system?
There is not, from the parents I've talked to,
okay.
And actually it should be easier for them to get any kind of services with the autism label rather than the Asperger's label.
So now with the autism label, are we talking about lots of more iterations of that spectrum now? Is that just what it's boiled down to, Brenda?
Yes, we're talking about a broad spectrum and recognizing, as Stephen Shore says, when you've seen one person with autism, you've seen one person with autism. And you can have different cognitive ability, different speech and language skills, different social skills, different sensory issues.
Diane, let's talk a little bit about just living with somebody who is diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, or first autism, then Asperger's. And tell us what your experience was with Mikey, just to give people an idea of what we're talking about, bearing in mind, of course, that everyone's a snowflake, so everyone's different.
Yes, Mikey was hyperactivity times 10, you know, when he was young. He was very, very hyperactive, but he did not understand language. And sometimes I think the higher functioning kids can be a little bit more difficult than the more moderately or to severe autistic kids when they're very young, just because there's so much more of an emotional problem there. He would get so frustrated. He realized he was different. He realized that he didn't understand like other people did. So he would scream and cry, and he never sat still for a second. He did not understand why he was supposed to do things that society, you know, expects you to do. And so he was just a handful. And back then, nobody even knew. They were not familiar with the word autism. So if I said he's autistic, they thought I was saying artistic, and they would look at me like, well, I don't care if he's a good artist. How come you're letting him act like that? I heard that so many times from people. Why are you letting him act like that? As if I was allowing it. And so it was very frustrating. I'm so glad now that there is so much more information and public knowledge about autism, so that parents like me are not continually being scoffed at and looked down on because they think that just because your kid looks normal, they don't understand why he isn't acting like the other kids. So he was a difficult child.
in looking at your memoir, you say that he never sat still for a second, but of course he did, because you took many, many gorgeous pictures of a beautiful baby and young child.
Yeah, he did. I always had the camera at the ready.
You sure
and
did.
I usually had to have him on the run, you know.
You noted the first time you made him sit at the table and eat some noodles, I think, or some chicken noodle soup or something.
Yes, he did not like to sit. He hated the sound of silverware on a plate. The sensory integration is a huge problem with them, and his hearing was almost acute. And so he did not like the sound of everybody else's silverware on the dinner plates. So I normally didn't make him sit at the table because it was just too much of an ordeal for him and the rest of us. But I was trying to get him, you know, to learn how to at least sit and eat instead of eating on the run, because if we had to go to a friend's house or family's house, I wanted him to try to fit in. And he did not like to sit. He just couldn't stand sitting still.
And yet, as he grew and aged, of course, there was a myriad experiences with him and changes and so forth. But he was quite talented, too. And yes, he was quite artistic.
Yes, he was very artistic. He really got into that and blossomed in high school. And then in college, he went to school to be a gunsmith because he loved the woodworking, the metal smithing. He loved all of that kind of stuff. And he loved to hunt, so he liked the guns. And so that kind of pulled all of his talents into one thing, and it was kind of the perfect occupation for him because it's a solo occupation. He's sitting alone at a gun bench designing something, and he blossomed. He was one of he was the only gunsmith at the place that he worked at that could do hand checkering and some of the designs they do. So he really took that skill and ran with it.
But, of course, you know, sadly, Mikey died. He committed suicide.
Yes.
I'm very sorry for your loss.
Oh, thank you. And I always want to make sure everybody understands his suicide was not autism or Asperger's related. Mikey had some kind of like a bipolar attack, and he had had manic behavior when he was very young, and he had seemed to outgrow it, and so he was never diagnosed with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia or anything like that. But he suffered a mental break. He became delusional, which we did not realize until after he killed himself and he had left a suicide note. So I always want to let everybody know that his suicide had nothing to do with autism or Asperger's, and it was a separate thing that he had going altogether.
What, Brenda Miles, is the incidence of these multiple diagnoses for people who have who are on the autism spectrum?
60% can have kind of that mental health overlay that Diane was talking about. And I think what she said was extremely important. Mm-hmm. You can have autism, and you can have autism with bipolar or other mental health issues. The two can be completely separate.
Well, Diane Bucci, thanks so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. You guys have a wonderful day.
You too. Diane Bucci, she's the author of The Return of Mikey. She's also a former president of the Autism Society of Colorado. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about Asperger's syndrome and what it means going forward as part of the broader autism spectrum. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The Senate's got one plan to overhaul the country's immigration laws. The president's got another. There may be room for compromise.
For the first time in many years, Republicans and Democrats seem ready to tackle this problem together.
But is that true in the House? I'm Neil Cohn in the coming fight over immigration policy. Next, Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon from 2 to 4 on 89.7 NPR News. Expect partly cloudy skies today with brisk winds and a high of 29 degrees. Clouds tonight and our cold snap continues with a low of 12 degrees. With the wind chill, it'll feel like minus 5. Partly cloudy and a high of only 18 on Friday. Support comes from the Midland Theater's Stage Door Cabaret Series, presenting each night, February 21st and 22nd at 8 p.m. Knight's career began as in country music, and over the years has broadened her scope to include blues, pop, jazz, and gospel. Tickets and more information at midlandtheater.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking this hour about Asperger's syndrome, which is set to be phased into the autism diagnosis category by the American Psychiatric Association. The disorder received additional attention recently during coverage of the Sandy Hook school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut. Early on, the media reported that the shooter had Asperger's, and some speculated about the connection between Asperger's and violence. Still with us is Brenda Miles, an associate professor, is a consultant at the Ohio Center for Autism and Low Incidence. Brenda, once again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And joining us now is Courtney Drake. She's a graduate student at Ohio State University, and she's also president of the OSU Mid-Ohio chapter of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. Welcome to the show, Courtney.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Courtney, were you diagnosed with autism or Asperger's syndrome?
Asperger's syndrome. Okay. Although I don't really differentiate between the two.
So you're not troubled by the change in the diagnosis?
I am, but I'm not.
Tell us why and why not.
I mean, I definitely agree with what she was saying. I think it kind of presents a dilemma, and that I think the functional labeling, how we currently look at autism as high functioning versus low functioning, is incredibly problematic. I think it also leads to pejoratizing the term autism in general. So I think combining them could be a blessing. However, on the other hand, I think that it raises a lot of concerns in regard to resource allocation, service provision. I think a lot of folks who could definitely benefit from supports may not be able to get them. I think we'll also see a decrease overall in, you know, autism diagnoses.
Well, that's a good point, because not only did they change the diagnosis labels, but they've changed what diagnoses people with autism. And Brenda Miles, I wonder if you could address that.
Well, what we're expecting in the DSM-5, first of all, as Courtney said, autism spectrum disorders is going to be the term. We will no longer have pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified, Asperger's syndrome. And the diagnostic criteria are going to focus on social communication as an entity, and then repetitive and restrictive behaviors. Also, they're going to be looking at levels of support as a way of defining whether an individual has autism. And so there's going to be a classification of individuals needing very substantial support, or just support.
I read that the number of ways to diagnose autism also have been reduced from more than 2,000 to just 11. That was kind of shocking. 2,000? Does that make sense to you?
Well, the DSM presents behavioral criteria. And so quite often, individuals are diagnosed by observation or by the use of specific instruments, and there are quite a few out there. One of the things that we have to really understand also is that autism manifests itself differently across the age span. And also that whole diversity, that snowflake effect. As I said earlier, Stephen Shore, and a friend of mine on the spectrum, is very fond of saying when you see one person with autism, you've seen one person with autism.
So let's talk about the violence part of it. That popped up during the Newtown, Connecticut tragedy, and it was interesting, and it's not unusual when something like that happens. People immediately want to know why. Why would a person do this? And any label that pops up about that person seems to be glommed onto. What, Courtney, was your reaction when you heard that a person diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome had done this and that they were making that connection in the media?
I mean, I really hate to say this, but the first thing I say is I wasn't surprised. I mean, we saw this occur in Aurora as well. We've actually seen this happen multiple times.
Aurora, where the theater shooting occurred.
Mm-hmm. I think that due to how politicized autism has become, and based on, you know, the fact that we as a culture typically really are consistently looking for difference in order to blame or scapegoat, it didn't surprise me. However, my reaction to it was very, I don't know, it was saddening. I mean,
I would imagine some people, and we were getting contacts from organizations and so forth that just want to run around saying, stop, stop, stop. It's not that simple. Right, Brenda?
Oh, it isn't that simple. You can have autism with a mental health overlay and autism without a mental health overlay. And the most recent tragic shooting, we really need to look at what sort of mental health supports we are providing to individuals who have mental health problems, regardless of whether they have autism or not.
Is it harder for people with autism or Asperger's, for the sake of the conversation today, to get treatment or to have other mental health issues recognized and dealt with in an appropriate and timely manner, Brenda? Because the autism is more pervasive or more accepted, or I don't know.
Well, quite often people don't recognize what autism is and its relationship to mental health issues and how some of those mental health issues can be manifest in individuals with autism spectrum disorders. And as such, we will see individuals who are experiencing those mental health challenges for a period of time that are just not getting that support either in school or in the community.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guests right now, Brenda Miles. She's a consultant at the Ohio Center for Autism and Low Incidence. Also, Courtney Drake. She's a social work graduate student at OSU and president of the OSU Mid-Ohio chapter of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. If you have a question or comment, we'd love to hear from other people out there who have children who are on the spectrum or who are themselves on the spectrum to get your reaction to some of the changes that are afoot. 614-292-8513. Or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. From Lori on Facebook, she says, I am a parent of a child who has Asperger's syndrome. I was initially concerned, but have read the new guidelines and still feel like my son will fit the diagnosis. I don't think anything will change for him in terms of services. Nancy in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Have a cold, so if my voice sounds kind of funny. I got to interview Tim Page a few years ago, and he had written a memoir titled Parallel Play. Are you familiar with that?
Yes.
And he's my age, so he grew up in the 60s, and of course they didn't diagnose people. But he's got Asperger's syndrome, and yet, you know, he's won the Pulitzer Prize. He's the classical music critic for the Washington Post. And my impression was, for people with Asperger's, the thing is to try to find the niche, you know, where you can best flourish with your particular interest. Wouldn't you say that's That's the difficulty for most people.
I was going to mention earlier when we were talking to Diane Bucci how lucky her son was to find that niche of building, you know, firearms and you know, combining his love of woodworking with, you know, machine working.
Mm-hmm. With Tim Page, he loved music, and yet when he worked in a music store as a young person, somebody would come up with an album or a cassette tape, or back what they called them back then, and he would say, "What are you listening to that crap for?" And so he wasn't successful with the public, but when he blended his two talents, writing and music, he wound up, you know, very successfully.
Brenda Miles?
Well, we need to keep in mind that individuals with autism have limitless potential, and that goes for individuals across the spectrum. And we do need to find the niche. We need to find the special interest and use those strengths to help teach skills and to guide individuals.
Courtney Drake, what about you? What's it been like finding your niche?
I mean, I definitely want to go off exactly what you said. I think that across the board, just to address before I get to you, that mm-hmm. original question is that everyone on the spectrum has limited, you know, or limitless abilities. But we're so focused on specifically looking at deficits that we rarely talk about these strengths. And as far as looking at a niche for me, I mean, my niche really changes. And I've always been involved in activism. I've always been interested in politics. And really, when I started working within my own community, that being the autistic community, everything just kind of connected. So
so your social work will be revolve around the autistic community?
Actually, I'm more specifically interested in looking at, are you ready? social justice in regard to social constructivism, deconstructivism, and how that works in regard to sociocultural constructs. I'm actually looking at also pursuing a PhD. I currently work as an intern at the Neisonger Center and work with teens on the spectrum. A strength-based approach, basically saying, you know, I know that you have this diagnosis. This doesn't define you. You guys are awesome. Let's work with your strengths, and let's go from there.
Nancy, thanks for your call. We appreciate it. Thank you. Becky in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Yeah. Welcome to the show, Becky.
Hi. My question is, you know, many more parents nowadays are insisting that their children be in the mainstream classrooms. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but there doesn't seem to be a budget for that. And I just wonder, perhaps, maybe, you know, there should be not just a special class, but a class where these children are perhaps, their strengths are brought out instead of them, you know, being punished for their behaviors.
Okay, what do you do consider punishment?
Well, I have heard that there are some schools that lock kids that are too active or non-attentive into closets. You know, I have heard of these instances, okay. And I think that's so terribly wrong.
And you think that that's because they're being mainstreamed, they're into the regular classroom.
Exactly. Okay. I think there's not enough teachers for the perhaps okay. special skills that these kids possess.
Okay, hang on a second. Brenda Miles, is there a concern about that, that it's a great idea, but we don't fund it properly enough?
Well, I think that education can always use additional support. With that being said, what we really need to do in schools is to ensure that we're looking at the individual with his or her strengths and needs and matching them to the sort of educational supports. And I'm using education in the broadest term to include social and sensory, et cetera, and provide that education. There are many, many students who do very well in a general education classroom if they are provided the support instruction that they need. Also, we really need to look at what skills do individuals need to be successful in life and to ensure that those skills are embedded in the educational program.
Courtney Drake, what was your education like growing up?
I actually went to a very small school, so a lot of my educational experiences aren't really translatable.
A rural school or?
Put-in Bay. I went to Put-in
Bay
school.
High School.
Very small school. Six people in my
right.
class, yes. Although I do think that she does have valid concerns, just to answer to that and to speak to what you said. I think it's also critical that we educate the educators in regard to understanding, you know, autistic behavior and communication and realizing that there's not just one way to think or just one way to behave. And I think that in doing that, we can also really assist kids.
What about the student body? What about fellow students, their classmates and so forth, and that sort of thing? Does that become a problem sometimes in some school situations?
Well, the primary way that it becomes a problem is that if there are bullies who have access to our folks on the spectrum, to treat them in a way that people should not be treated. You mentioned social justice. But research has shown, and my personal experience has shown, that neurotypical peers in a classroom with individuals with autism benefit greatly because they learn that people do learn differently and people have different perspectives, and that sometimes the way that people are presenting does not reflect their being. So I know many individuals who have benefited. My own nephew, when he was 3, was, back in the days of reverse mainstreaming, was a peer model. And he never realized that his friends on the spectrum didn't speak, that they were nonverbal. And one of the kiddos in the class was a biter. He learned how to release a bite. And now one of his very good friends is a person on the spectrum.
Becky, thanks for your call.
No problem. Thank you.
Care. You bet. 6 kids in your classroom. That is extremely unusual, but I'm wondering, conversely, do you think that that was a better way? Did you feel like, given your circumstances, because there were so few children, you had a better chance for your teacher to get to know you and understand what you needed?
Yes and no. I think just due to, obviously, I'm originally from outside of Dayton and grew up in larger schools and then moved there. I think that smaller schools can be a blessing and a curse. I mean, for me, school just wasn't challenging enough. Like, the academics just weren't there.
Okay.
So it was a lot more supportive, socially speaking, in the school, not necessarily in the community.
Mm-hmm.
But academically speaking, it wasn't really what I needed.
Brenda?
And you're never going to find one school or one program that fits all people with autism.
Because
it's all about the match.
Right.
And the resources.
To what extent, some people might say, well, how can you expect every school district to adapt to and provide the services for every person who's autistic because every single one of them is different from each other?
Well, actually, it does require a lot of work, but what we see are tremendous benefits. Part of the issue is that in transitions from year to year or agency to agency, we do not share what we know about the individual with autism. And so the third grade teachers who are working with our child, and that child is doing very well, the child transitions to fourth grade, and the fourth grade team basically starts over. And so we spend a lot of time getting to know our individuals with autism. So planning and knowing the individual can make all the difference in the world.
Well, Courtney Drake, thanks for joining us today to help us out with this conversation. We appreciate it.
And thank you for having me.
Courtney Drake, she's a social work graduate student at OSU. She's also president of the OSU Mid-Ohio chapter of the Autistic Self-Advocacy Network. We'll be back and continue our conversation about autism and Asperger's syndrome. If you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and stay with us in just about 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. Hour 2 of All Sides begins with a discussion of immigration reform and what it might look like this time around. Join us for All Sides. It begins from 11 till noon here on 89.7 NPR News. And be sure to watch Columbus on the Record Friday night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, News Director Mike Thompson and his panel provide an in-depth analysis of several topics, including Governor Kasich's education overhaul plan and budget surpluses at the State House and Columbus City Hall. That's Columbus on the Record. It's tomorrow night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. 24 degrees in downtown Columbus, scattered snow showers today and windy, with a high of 29 degrees. Cloudy skies tonight with still some scattered snow, a low of 12 degrees, and partly cloudy for Friday, and a high of just 18. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is 89.7 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides. This hour, we've been discussing Asperger syndrome, soon to be considered part of autism spectrum disorder by the American Psychiatric Association, instead of a separate diagnosis. Still with us is Brenda Miles, she is a consultant at the Ohio Center for Autism and Low Incidence. And joining us now is Dr. Andrea Whitwer. She's assistant professor of clinical psychiatry and psychology and director of the Autism Spectrum Disorder Clinic at the Neisinger Center at OSU. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
How will the DSM-5 changes change or affect your work at the Neisinger Center?
I think, and that's a very good question, even just from the basics of the DSM will be released in May of 2013, and our diagnostic team has started to discuss how we want to incorporate the different changes in the criteria into our practice. Now, on a large scale, I don't think it's going to impact necessarily how we're assessing things at first, but we're going to add in some different aspects. You know, the DSM is adding in, under the restricted and repetitive behaviors, a criteria looking at sensory sensitivity as well as sensory seeking behavior. So we'll want to be able to make sure we're incorporating that into our diagnostic assessment.
When you say sensory seeking, you mean somebody who likes the feel of something or
Correct.
Likes the sound of something?
Yes, so it can be someone who's really interested in feelings of material, such that they'll walk up to different people or individuals and want to feel the silk of their shirt, or wanting to walk along a wall and feel the way it feels. Others, it's seeing how things taste and wanting to taste things. Also visually, looking at things at different angles because they're interested in how they appeal to them visually.
You know, a lot of what you're just describing, though, sounds like things that I used to feel or think when I was a kid. I mean, we're talking about things that everybody sort of shares at some point in their life, but to an extreme, right?
Right. And that's, we think of, you know, it's the autism spectrum. So when we're looking at something that's clinically significant, it would be, you know, I really like silky shirts, but an individual on the spectrum may not realize that it's not appropriate. They want to seek that out everywhere they go. So if they see a silky shirt, they're going to walk up to all of those that they see to seek it out. So it's looking at an abnormal and intense interest is that qualitative difference.
Brenda Miles?
Well, we also have a number of people with autism who have challenges in regulating sensory input, it appears. They can see the number of times that a fluorescent light flickers. Information that they hear seems to be maybe more loud or distorted. And so, similar to the autism spectrum being a spectrum, the sensory challenges are also along a spectrum. I know kids who can tell that if they're parent has changed laundry detergent by the way the clothing feels on their body. So sensory can be extremely complex.
Dr. Whitwer, we were talking earlier about the number of ways to diagnose autism and how as of May 2013, they'll be reduced from more than 2,000 to just 11. And one of the concerns about that has been that some people feel like they're going to fall through the cracks, that with the 2,000 plus portals, if you will, they weren't lost in the mix. This way they might be.
Well, and I think it's looking at, I'm not sure what they're talking about there. I'm guessing it's the number of different assessment instruments that are out there that possibly could be used. I think when we look at evidence-based practice, there are still a select number of instruments that still will be effective in identifying a large proportion of individuals who would have been diagnosed with DSM-4 and will be again with DSM-5. You know, I think we still need to look at, we're going to be refining the criteria and also looking at the instruments we're using to see if they need to be addressed as we look forward to implementing DSM-5.
Brenda?
Yeah, I think that it's going to become more and more important for individuals who assess those with autism to really have a firm grounding in what autism is. One of the things that I said earlier is that for individuals who are being assessed in school to see if they have autism, the new DSM is more in line with what education looks at as far as identification. So that's a plus.
You can give us a call if you want to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Tara. She says, as an adult, I was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. I am also ADHD. I usually just explain to people that Asperger's is on the spectrum and that I am just socially awkward. I feel that it doesn't define me, and most people are surprised because I am considered high-functioning. Mostly just close friends and family know that I have Asperger's because I don't want to be stigmatized. So I suppose that's pretty common, and I'm wondering about the adult diagnosis part of that and how common that is. Brenda Miles?
Well, some people embrace the autism diagnosis as adults.
Because they think finally it explains?
Absolutely. Someone finally understands them. And also it gives them the opportunity to realize that they have limitless potential, because autism really is not a limiting factor. Other people, and quite often it's folks who believe that the term autism is a pejorative term, will prefer to have that term remain in the background.
Andrea Whitwer, anything to add to that?
No, I think I would just agree. It very much appears to be, even with the families that we see, personal choice, as well as whether they want to, you know, let everyone know and communicate the diagnosis versus choosing to not have, you know, if they're afraid their child may be stigmatized, not wanting to, you know, let that be known to their larger community.
Getting back to the issue of the number of ways to diagnose autism, some people think that that might also reduce the number of people that are diagnosed with autism. Is that a concern or something of interest to you, Dr. Whitwer?
Definitely, and I think it's something we're going to be monitoring. We look at there's been a number of studies that have kind of argued both ways, I think, as some of your previous guests have talked about. You know, when we look at it, some of the studies that say we're going to miss a large proportion of people, the problem with those studies is they were based on looking at archival data. So I think it's going to be one of these things we're going to have to be refining how we're diagnosing in those pieces as we go forward. And also looking, some of the other studies have brought concerns about underrepresented populations, such as the individual women, and how they might be diagnosed, and concerns that maybe DSM-5 may not be able to be sensitive enough to their symptoms. So I think those are going to be things as a research community that we're really going to be paying close attention to and constantly, you know, the goal with research is to inform clinical practice. So making sure that our research is addressing this from the get-go is going to be very important.
Hodan, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Ben. And I'm a long-time listener.
Thank you.
I'm glad, you know, I talked to you today.
I'm sorry, we can't hear you.
Yes, hi. I want to talk to you about, and while I was driving, I heard that that's progress in syndrome. I was working with a student. I'm not a social worker, but I do outreach program, and I have been working with Columbus City Schools in 12 years, but I don't work for them. And especially I work with Somali kids, and it's hard to identify when kids are ESL and, you know, about
English as a second language. It's hard to identify them if they have Asperger's or autism.
Yeah, but this kid was, and I think, identified when he was in elementary school about 7 years ago. Now he's a junior, like grade 11. And he doesn't have any friends. He's a loner, but academically he's very good. He's 4.0, but the only friends he has is like school social work or one of his teachers. And now he realized that, you know, he's different, but he doesn't know how to deal with. And I can't say a lot because I don't want to say a lot,
sure.
But I know this kind of diseases is hard for immigrant families to identify or know, or also the stigma, because as a Somalian, we don't like to, you know, identify with our children about things like the, you know, American families accept or they find resources so they can help the children.
It's an interesting question about children or anyone with English as a second language, an immigrant. There's a lot of factors that come into play that don't otherwise. Brenda Miles, what do we know about that?
Well, what we see are individuals who are underrepresented in population. We see females who are diagnosed to a lesser extent than males or individuals who are Caucasian. And quite often it has to do with understanding culture and understanding autism.
And do you find an underrepresentation with immigrants, people from different ethnic backgrounds?
Absolutely. Research has clearly shown that difference.
Andrea, what were any thoughts about that?
Yes, and I think it's been especially, you know, the caller was talking about the Somali community, and it's something we've discussed here with some representatives of the Somali community. You know, there's been a big push, as everyone knows, for autism awareness within the general community, but the methods and the manner in which we do that type of publicity doesn't necessarily reach the Somali community. I think to the credit, at least of the Somali community, they've been trying to pull in speakers and trying to work in educating their parents so that they understand autism, they understand the causes, so that it reduces some of that stigma. I think education is really, when it gets into getting into different cultures, it's really important to educate them and to realize that the methods may not, I think we were talking with some Somali representatives that said, you know, really spoken word is the best way in which they can communicate things to those in their community. So I think we, as you know, an organization and just as a community in general, need to be thinking about how can we educate these different cultural groups so that they understand.
One of the things that we're working on at Ocali is exactly that issue, is to develop a strategic plan on how to reach family members from underrepresented groups. Because what we know is that the earlier the individual is diagnosed, the more we can provide supports and education.
Hodan, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Take care. Sebastian in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome, Sebastian.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to let you know that I'm a very high-functioning adult living with Asperger's syndrome, and I am about to graduate from The Ohio State University. And me being 31 years old, I have to tell you, I had to go through many years of being misunderstood. I was bullied at school. You know, and living in New Jersey was not, you know, the most, it wasn't the best place to live in terms of establishing relationships. Like I said, I'll be brief since there's a little bit of time in conversation.
Well, congratulations about your imminent graduation.
I also, Diane Rehm, I also have to tell you that I did write a memoir. I am almost finished with one of the chapters. I have reviewed it, edited it, and I'm about to hand it in to a publisher or something.
There are a lot of great memoirs out there now, and once again, because everybody's different, they bring something to the table every time now. Brenda Miles, is that helping too?
I think that the more the public becomes aware of autism through memoirs or knowing individuals on the spectrum, the more acceptance we'll have, and then also I think that we'll have higher expectations for our folks with autism, because there's no reason that an individual with autism, just like your caller, you know, cannot attend college, graduate, and be very successful in life.
Sebastian, what do you think about the decision to make Asperger's syndrome part of the autism spectrum disorder officially and to do away with the Asperger label?
Well, basically, from what I can understand from the question, is that everything has to do with where you're at on the spectrum. Some people can be perceived as normal, like me. Nobody can ever even figure that I have autism at all. However, I do present some symptoms. I do train in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I'm a fighter, so. That's actually boosted up my confidence level. I've been training under Carlson Gracie team in Grandview with Carlos Carvalho all this time. So it's actually boosted up my confidence, because I know that whatever can happen out there, I know that I can go to a bar and think that nobody's ever going to start a fight with me. You know, and, you know, it's those kinds of things that, you know, like if you take like self-defense classes, for example, they help you out with your self-esteem. I mean, I know a couple other cases of people who have done martial arts and their self-esteem just skyrocketed,
That's an interesting point. Thank you very much, Sebastian, for your call. We appreciate it.
Absolutely, Diane Reem. Thank you very much.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We have an email from Rose. It is important for those on the spectrum to consider participating in research. Only about 5% of those on the spectrum actively participate in autism research. By doing that, they will be contributing to our understanding of the condition. ResearchMatch.org is an NIH-sponsored volunteer registry and has just recently launched the first sub-registry devoted to best helping connect researchers and those on the spectrum. She says that researchers at OSU and nationwide Children's Hospital use this registry to help enroll participants in their studies. Dr. Andrea Whitwer, how do you get people to participate in studies?
It's really about publicizing it so that families and individuals are aware of all of the great work that's being done out there. I think when you, like the emailer said, it's really important that we get individuals across the spectrum who can participate in research. And the thing about it is it helps to inform the larger community in those, but there's also a lot of really innovative projects going on. So you can, at least if we educate individuals that they can be at the part of cutting-edge treatments, and cutting-edge research, it's really a win-win for both families and the larger community in general.
Paul, on the east side of Columbus, we are running out of... Paul, you have to turn off. You have to turn off your radio.
Yes, it's off. Okay. I was off, so on.
We are running out of time, but I wanted to squeeze you in. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to mention as a resource, Brookwood Academy. I have an autistic son. I mean, autistic Asperger's son, autistic spectrum. They keep changing names on him, and he's high functioning, but he has trouble with large groups of people, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they're a charter school that is basically has been very, very good for him.
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Bye.
I want to thank Brenda Miles for joining us today. Brenda, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Brenda Miles is a consultant at the Ohio Center for Autism and Low Incidence. Also, Dr. Andrea Whitwer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Whitwer is an assistant professor of clinical psychiatry and psychology. She's also director of the Autism Spectrum Disorder Clinic at the Neisinger Center at The Ohio State University. Thanks to everybody for listening. If you... you've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.